from WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Wartime wounds were reopened last month in two countries. In the United States, former Senator Bob Kerry acknowledged his role in what may or may not have been a Vietnam War atrocity 4 decades ago. Coverage here was marked by a striking sympathy, or at least empathy, for Kerry's feelings now, then, and in between.
In France, there was another grisly revelation, a book by a retired army general describing in detail systematic torture and killings by French troops against suspected Algerian revolutionaries 40 years ago. But unlike America, where the horrors of Vietnam have long since been exposed, France's dirty secrets from the Algeria War have seldom penetrated the public consciousness. So suddenly, the French media are in high dudgeon. Joining us now is Sylvie Kaufman, New York bureau chief for the newspaper Le Monde. Ms. Kaufman, welcome to On the Media.
Hello.
You can't judge a man till you've walked in his shoes. This has been the phrase we have heard over and over again since Bob Kerry's story broke. Are the press saying anything remotely like that about General Alcarrás and his revelations about torture in Algeria?
Basically, in France, this is new. Everybody sort of knew or assumed that there had been torture used as a policy, in fact, in the Algerian War. But nobody had ever really so openly admitted it. I think the American public has been confronted with the atrocities in Vietnam much more openly than we have in France been confronted with Algeria.
So how have the media treated General Alcarrás?
The media are treating him quite harshly. General Alcarrás basically says, yes, I did use torture. Yes, I did kill people under torture. Yes, I did order people to be killed under torture. And he's very open, frank, and unashamed about it. So that makes it difficult to feel a lot of sympathy for him.
On the other hand, he was acting out of French national policy at the time.
Yes, that's his excuse. That's what he says.
Is anyone asking, you know, where was Le Monde for the last 35 years?
Well, actually, no, nobody's asking because I think the media did their job. It's a very interesting process. I think the public didn't want to know. The evidence was there, in fact. There were movies, there were books, and there were articles in the newspapers and in the magazines. And Le Monde was, in fact, in the late 50s, the first paper to say, look, torture is being used and this is not good. Even though some journalists, some movie makers, some writers, some historians were telling them, the public just was not buying this thing. It's totally different from what you experience with Vietnam.
I think it's true throughout Europe that newspapers tend to be associated or even affiliated with political points of view, places in the political spectrum. Is there a difference in the way this story is playing in Le Monde as opposed to, for example, Le Figaro, which is a right-wing paper?
Absolutely. Le Figaro is an excellent newspaper, but it's very close to, it used to be very close to De Gaulle and then to his political legacy. And so they're in a very uncomfortable position right now. And they're not giving a big coverage to this issue at the moment. Le Monde is really doing a lot. Libération is following, is not in the lead, but they're giving it a lot of space. L'Humanité, of course, which is the communist newspaper, is very aggressive in its coverage and in its condemnation of torture. But, of course, L'Humanité and the Communist Party are nothing anymore. So that reaches very, very few readers. But Le Figaro, I must say, stands out as giving very little space and less than it deserves.
At the news of these revelations about systematic torture and murder, President Jacques Chirac said he was horrified, and Prime Minister Lionel Jospin said he was deeply shocked by the reports. I think of Claude Rains and his character in Casablanca. He was shocked that gambling was going on in the establishment. Is the French public buying this, and are the media buying their reactions? Do they think that this is a surprise to the heads of government and state in France?
No, I don't think they're buying this, of course. I think the politicians were taken by surprise by this. They didn't expect this to be so big. They didn't expect the media to play it so strongly, and they probably didn't expect the public to react so actively.
Sylvie Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Sylvie Kaufman is the New York bureau chief for the French newspaper Le Monde.
Last week, we asked you to respond to public radio's broadcast of the execution tapes. Listeners responded from every side of the issue, including those who said they had heard enough already, we should change the subject. Agreed. But first, some of your thoughts.
Elena Gerst from New York City says that she supports capital punishment as a logical means to rid society of those who are convicted of crimes so heinous as to invite the death penalty. However, she writes, I feel that broadcasting them brings us one step closer to the barbarism of periods of history from which we attempt to set ourselves apart as a more informed, civilized society.
It is no surprise that public radio would broadcast the execution, wrote Robert Huber of New Brighton, Minnesota. Ratings are important even with no advertisers, and there's probably an agenda behind it. We will end with this observation from Frederick Armstrong Fox of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. I heard the rebroadcast of the excerpt, and my opinion remains unchanged, he wrote. I found no entertainment value in the recording. Such an event is a matter of the gravest solemnity. Only a very sick pup would derive any pleasure from it. I hasten to add that a distinction exists between closure and ghoulish delight. We want to hear your opinion on any subject we tackle here on the Media, so write us at onthemedia@wnyc.org.
Ronnie Biggs, a fugitive who escaped jail in the United Kingdom nearly 30 years ago for his part in the famous Great Train Robbery, has been flown back to Britain from Brazil, where he had been on the run. As a 71-year-old in poor health, Biggs now has to serve out the remaining 28 years of his prison sentence.
It wasn't British detectives who tracked Biggs down and brought him home, nor was it the government, but a tabloid newspaper. This is the latest of a series of cases in which Britain's popular papers have shown their power goes beyond mere news reporting. Our correspondent in London, Gareth Mitchell, takes a look at tabloid newspaper culture in the UK.
The tabloid which spent a pile of money flying Ronnie Biggs home is The Sun newspaper, one of the UK's most popular dailies. The Sun was delighted with all the publicity in getting such a scoop, but such checkbook journalism could be in breach of regulations set down by the newspaper industry's self-regulatory body, the Press Complaints Commission, or PCC. The commission's director is Guy Black.
The code that we operate deals with one specific aspect of checkbook journalism, and that is payment to convicted criminals or their associates for stories. Editors themselves judge it unethical to pay criminals unless there is a public interest in the story that they obtain by payment.
The Sun insists that bringing a convicted criminal back home to face justice is in the public interest, and it only opened its checkbook to pay Biggs' expenses. But the Press Complaints Commission has no legal powers anyway. As the press industry's own regulator, it can merely require offenders to print an apology in a prominent place. The PCC's code was drawn up in 1991 as an attempt to keep a check on reckless journalism whilst also maintaining a free press. Guy Black is convinced that the code, despite some inevitable imperfections, works.
I think, you know, it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. Probably something, things to do with a free press never should be perfect. A free press is always going to have rough edges, but like democracy itself. But there's no doubt that standards have been raised. The sorts of intrusions into individual privacy that we saw 15 years ago have disappeared completely. That sort of behaviour is unimaginable these days.
There may be more fair play within the industry these days, but tabloid journalists are no less hungry for big stories. The News of the World, one of Britain's oldest newspapers, but in its modern form a punchy campaigning weekly tabloid, famously lifted the lid on a scandal involving a member of Britain's royal family a few weeks ago. Sophie Wessex, married to Prince Edward, the Queen's son, ran a successful public relations company in London. The News of the World suspected that Sophie Wessex was using her royal status to drum up business for the firm. The paper dispatched a reporter masquerading as a wealthy potential client to arrange a meeting with the young royal and her business partner. News of the World executive editor Robert Warren.
The subterfuge we were using, which is one we do use from time to time, was one of our reporters adopts the identity of an Arab sheik. They obviously didn't know they were talking to the News of the World, but the technique worked extremely well, and she talked rather too freely about what she could do and what she thought about various people, which gave us a remarkably good story.
It was a very good story. The News of the World itself made headlines around the UK and internationally. Sophie Wessex was forced to step down as a director of the company, and the incident really shook the royal family up.
That afternoon, Buckingham Palace issued a statement in which they said they realised there were things wrong, the way members of the royal family conducted their businesses, and there was going to be a major inquiry into it, and they were going to look into the whole thing and straighten it out.
That ability to shake up institutions like the monarchy is just one example of the power popular newspapers wield, especially as a general election looms and politicians are keen to get their message across. In fact, many would say that one of the most influential people in the country in the run-up to an election is the political editor of the Sun newspaper. Chris Horry, journalist and author of Stick It Up Your Punter, a book which examines tabloid culture, says that for politicians, it's vital to get newspapers like the Sun on your side, or more importantly, make sure they're not against you.
By zeroing in at character assassination, they can put off enough swing voters, the kind of people who are not that interested in politics, the kind of people who are going to make an impressionistic decision, can be very swayed by negative campaigning. The kind of negative campaigning in the States you get in the hard-hitting TV ads, you will find on the front page of tabloids here, they are deeply feared. And it's generally thought that you cannot win an election in the UK with the Sun against you. And no political party has won an election in the UK with the Sun against it since the Sun was launched in 1969. They have that power.
And the newspaper's power derives from its readership, an audience it wouldn't get without its ethics-straining scoops. In the battle for readership and power, tabloids will, from time to time, breach their watchdog's regulations and have to print the required apology. No doubt the retraction, prominent though it may be, will be eclipsed by tomorrow's big scandal all over the front page. For On the Media, this is Gareth Mitchell in London.
Coming up, what the advertising recession means to news coverage. Also, does journalism school benefit journalism? And don't miss our shocking story about local news.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. While the Federal Reserve and Wall Street quibble over whether the economy is in recession, there is one place where the question is not in doubt. That would be the media business, where an advertising drought has devastated revenues in broadcast, online, and print media alike. For example, in the last reporting period, the magazine industry sold 10% fewer ad pages than a year ago. Newspaper chain Knight Ridder saw its March ad revenues decline 6% from the year 2000. Inevitably, such declines result in cuts in editorial budgets. Joining us now to discuss what that portends is media securities analyst John Morton of Morton Research. John, how bad is it out there?
It looks as though in the first 3 months of this year that advertising revenues for newspaper companies fell more drastically than any time in anybody's memory. So it's a very, very sharp decline, and regardless of whether the national economy is officially in a recession, the newspaper industry certainly is.
I guess something else is different. If this is the sharpest drop in recent memory, it's also at a time when a greater percentage of daily newspapers in this country are owned by public companies than ever before. Isn't that true?
That is true. The public ownership now represents about pretty close to 60% of national daily circulation.
So when public ownership meets advertising recession, what happens?
Well, unfortunately, what's been happening is layoffs, restraints on, you know, editorial initiatives, travel. There has been some squeezing of news holes, the amount of space devoted to news.
Now, I know you're a newspapers guy, but you cover media companies in general. What's happening in television and magazines as well?
Well, they're having some of the same difficulties, although not quite as dramatic as in newspapers, because the biggest part of the decline in newspaper advertising has been in classified advertising.
How severely have layoffs reached the newsroom?
It's not dramatic, but Knight Ridder, for example, at most of its newspapers has announced layoffs. Most recently in St. Paul, before that in Akron, and in Philadelphia, and San Jose, they kind of backed off of it a little bit when the publisher resigned. And the New York Times has said it is going to be laying off some. Dow Jones has been doing that.
How cold-hearted, how ruthless do these companies have to be to keep Wall Street happy?
Well, in some respects, as ruthless as they have to be, Wall Street is not sentimental about the newspaper business. It's become very short-nosed. They really only care about, you know, what's going to happen the next quarter and this year. And bear in mind that Knight Ridder and Tribune Company and Gannett are three newspaper companies that have only one class of stock. And so, theoretically, they could be vulnerable to an unfriendly takeover if they don't perform well. All the other major publicly owned newspaper companies have two classes of stock. The families hold the voting stock, and it's not traded. So it's not really as crucial a thing for them as it is for, say, Knight Ridder and Tribune and Gannett.
I've read a number of comments from people on Wall Street saying to complainers in the newsroom, get a life. You just have to understand that you're not working for a newspaper. You're working for an advertising medium. You're working for a business. But isn't there a comparable argument that can be made to people on Wall Street that there is no business unless there's some level of quality journalism?
Well, right. I mean, the newspaper business is different, say, from your average green bean canner. I mean, I recall, years ago when I used to spend a lot of time on Wall Street trying to talk institutions into investing in newspaper companies, I met one analyst who said, he really likes newspapers because when times get tough, they can always cut loose some reporters and editors who, after all, aren't revenue producers. And that's, I think, a fairly typical attitude, as though these folks don't produce revenues. Well, of course they produce revenues. I mean, what do they think they're selling out there?
When Jay Harris left the San Jose Mercury because of the profit pressures, which he said would put an undue burden on the editorial operations,
Yeah. He
was roundly applauded by editors around the country. In fact, literally got a standing ovation when he spoke at the American Society of News Editors.
Right.
Can the editorial side of newspapers stand up to their publishers and stand up to Wall Street, or are they just going to have to take their licks?
They'll just have to take their licks. I mean, I think what Jay did was very symbolic, and I think it may have given some newspaper executives some pause. But how can you stand up to Wall Street if they hand you the pink slip? I mean, there's not much that you can do about it.
John Morton, thanks very much for joining us.
All right, bye.
Securities analyst John Morton runs Morton Research. Joining me now is Mike Burback, editor of the Columbus, Georgia Ledger Inquirer, and Knight Ridder paper, where budget cuts have found their way into the newsroom. Mike, what's the damage so far?
We took one position out of the editorial page. We took one position out of the copy desk. And we took one, the person whom we let go was a community reporter.
So is there anything that you're not covering that you would have otherwise covered if the times weren't so lean?
Not yet. We're doing our best to try to make our cutbacks and our trims invisible to readers.
What about the news hole? I imagine that has been shrinking somewhat.
I think if we really got down and analyzed the heck out of it, we would find that we have somewhat less news hole this year than last year, but not by a huge amount.
Do you know what the profit margins are that your publisher has to meet at the Ledger Inquirer? Have you been meeting them the last 4 years?
We have.
And is the expectation from Knight Ridder that your margins increase, that you stay stable? Are they willing to give you the benefit of the doubt in this recessionary period? What are you hearing from above?
Well, it's no secret at all that Knight Ridder has set goals to outperform its peers. And to do that, you have to keep improving your financial performance. So, no, they expect us to do better.
Have you had to bite your lip to senior management?
No, I'm not biting my lip. You know, I don't spend any time whining because I figure that's a waste of my energy and everybody else's. I don't like cuts. I would rather that I had, you know, one of the millions that we send to Knight Ridder shareholders, but I don't. I'd rather I was 6'6" and could dunk a basketball, but I'm not.
And of those 52,000 subscribers, have you gotten a single letter complaining about what's missing from the Ledger Inquirer?
Nope.
Do you run Beetle Bailey?
Beetle Bailey, yep, we still run Beetle.
What would happen if you dropped Beetle Bailey? How many letters would you get?
How many letters would we get if we dropped Beetle? We'd probably get a few hundred, which is quite a few for a paper our size.
Mike Burback, thanks for joining us.
Yep, thank you. Good luck.
Thank you. Mike Burback is editor of the Columbus, Georgia Ledger Inquirer.
So, generating high profit margins in the current nervous economy requires cutbacks and hiring freezes. Where does that leave the aspiring cub reporter, frequently with no prospects and an impressive pile of debt? It could be argued that they might have been better off if they'd skipped grad school altogether and gone straight into the job market when the getting was good. On the Media's Dave Sirchuk looks into the pros and cons of journalism school after this brief word from Jason Robards.
Sweat deep throat.
He's not a source on this.
Look, do any of them have an axe?
No.
Personal, political, sexual? Is there anything at all on Mitchell?
No.
Then can we use the names?
No.
God damn it, when is somebody going to go on the record in this story?
Watergate was a watershed, not only for American history, but also for journalism schools. The reporting of the Washington Post led to a boom in applications that helped gentrify this hard-living, blue-collar profession. Cynthia Gorney is an associate professor at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism.
If you go to a newsroom now, like the Post or the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune, it has been pointed out frequently and accurately that you're looking at people who have mortgages, who have kids in private schools, and who don't have nearly as much in common with the sort of mythic folks on the street as was the case in the heyday of Mike Royko or Jimmy Breslin or some of the famous newsmen who did much of their reporting in bars.
Fewer people now want to write about issues like underdog issues about poverty and ordinary people.
Rick Rodriguez is the executive editor of the Sacramento Bee.
Cops used to be a learning ground to learn how to report, and we're getting folks out of journalism school now who say, you know, I don't want to cover cops. A lot of the folks coming out of journalism school now don't think that they have to pay those kinds of dues.
Mark Stamey, a grad of Columbia J School 93 and a New York Post reporter, believes his school went out of its way to promote white-collar stories and journalists.
I thought that the subjects themselves were very safe. They avoided the unpleasantness, the vicissitudes of life. They were uncluttered by a lot of grit, dirt, whatever happens. You know, they don't teach people to sneak into a place, take notes unobserved, and sneak out.
Columbia student Rebecca Nolan spent 4 years gaining proficiency as a beat reporter before going to get her master's degree. She felt Columbia put too much focus on the academic side of journalism rather than the practice.
It's heavy on theory sometimes at Columbia and not on specifics, which can be frustrating. We could talk about the philosophy of journalism until the sun goes down, but what we need to know when we hit the streets for our first job at, like, the Wenatchee Journal is what it's actually going to be like day to day.
For Columbia journalism professor James Carey, such theoretical issues as the First Amendment, privacy rights, and libel laws are as important as writing a good lead. But, he adds, at Columbia people learn to do that, too.
95% of it is spent on practice. I just would have no idea what such a person is talking about. The only way I can interpret it, and which doesn't speak, is this is someone who is completely anti-intellectual and thinks that there's no reflection at all needed about what it is journalists do. If that's the case, it's not the way most accomplished journalists think about it, certainly.
I believe that today's journalists are smarter than ever.
Glenn Guzzo is the editor of the Denver Post.
I think you've seen more analysis in newspapers with each decade.
The Sacramento Bee's Rick Rodriguez agreed that J-School grads often bring specialized knowledge to the field.
More and more you're seeing folks specialize in business or technology reporting that has bled out in the newsroom. So I guess there's a trade-off. They're becoming very proficient in that one area, but maybe then that leaves them with little or no experience in talking to everyday people.
But real-life experience is getting harder to come by. This year's J-School grads will move into a media world hobbled by hiring freezes. This was made clear to Columbia student Amanda Levin during the graduate school's annual jobs fair late last March. Four of Levin's eight interviews canceled on her. And for those news organizations that stayed, the situation was bleak.
Although they were accepting resumes, they explained that they were laying off people, so there were no prospects.
Levin's Columbia classmates fared little better.
It's like walking into a room of artificiality. It's a bit like depressing, but at the same time, I think it's hilarious. I mean, I'm not going to get a job today, and I don't think anyone is here.
Everyone is downsizing, you know, all this talk about recession and things like those. So there's no job. We should just put up a notice and say, no jobs for graduate students, period.
But if these students feel their expensive degrees may not lead to jobs, period, why would anyone go? In a word, alumni. For if journalism schools can't provide jobs, they can provide the next best thing, access to a network that may eventually get you jobs.
From what I've heard, the alumni network is really amazing, and I think there are we have a lot of books of alumni listings, and you can just call them and say, hey, I'm a J student, I need a job, and I know you went to Columbia, do you want to hook me up?
Of course, people also go to improve their writing. Rebecca Nolan, with her emphasis on practicality, says she did pick up at least one valuable writing tip. She learned how to use commas correctly. For On the Media, I'm David Sirchak.
A Denver-based organization called the Rocky Mountain Media Watch has submitted an unusual petition to the Federal Trade Commission. They are asking the FTC to ban the local TV stations from advertising their nightly newscasts as news. Quoting from the petition, "The programs are substantially non-news, comprised of violence, mayhem, entertainment, and fluff. This false and deceptive advertising contravenes the station's obligations as public trustees." Joining me now is the chairman of the board of the Rocky Mountain Media Watch, Jason Salzman. Welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Jason, just because you'd like the local stations to feature more serious and important stories, does that make what they're doing not news?
Individually, some stories can be considered news, but if you look at their broadcasts in the main, the news broadcasts, they basically cover four topics: weather, sports, violence, which is crime and disaster, and celebrity fluff. Now, according to the Society of Professional Journalists and journalistic standards that are widely accepted, that is not news. News should contain diverse opinions, a balance of stories, so that people can be informed in a democracy. So we don't think they broadcast news on their programs.
Well, that the news covers crime and murder, and you even put coverage of war into your petition, does this really run afoul of what you think the definition of news is?
Oh, absolutely not. They should cover those topics, violent topics, topics that people don't want to see. But day after day, to repeat the same very narrow band of topics, that's not news. It becomes entertainment. For years, we've done extensive content analysis of these shows, and they don't just do it a day here and a day there. This is their fare constantly. That's why we think they're not informing the public, and they shouldn't say they are. They shouldn't call it news.
Now, you know there's no real definition of news. It's just the plural of new. So what a tabloid covers and what The Economist covers are very different subjects. But are you saying that the tabloids aren't covering the news?
Local TV news stations are licensed to broadcast in the public interest. So we think they have a heightened standard. And we're only asking them to meet their own professional journalistic standards of news. We don't think it's appropriate for a public trustee to lure news consumers to their entertainment shows by calling them news. It's that simple.
If you found that the next few episodes of Frasier weren't funny, would you petition the FTC to stop NBC from labeling it a comedy?
In their roles as public trustees, the stations aren't required to make things funny. But they are required to broadcast news and information that citizens need.
Now, last year you petitioned the FCC to deny license renewals to local stations. What happened then?
The FCC came back to us and said that they don't regulate content. You know, they don't want to violate the station's First Amendment rights. Fair enough. This time we're saying they can broadcast whatever they want. They can broadcast mayhem all the time around the clock. Just don't call it news. This gets around the censorship issue. We're not censoring what they're saying. We're not telling them to not broadcast certain topics. We're just saying if it's not news, don't call it news. Don't engage in false advertising.
Well, let me ask you this then. Suppose in the remote possibility that the FTC actually does act on your petition, then what do the stations do? Do they make news and then do they have to go back to the FTC? And then are you asking the government to decide what is news and what isn't?
Just as the FTC sets advertising standards for other industries, they can do that for these news broadcasting stations.
But the FCC won't even do that.
The FCC rejected our complaint because they didn't want to censor the news. We're saying you can broadcast infotainment, just call it that.
You're asking the government to judge what is valuable material and what isn't.
No, we're asking the government to make sure that these stations are engaging in truthful advertising. That's it.
If it's not news, what do you think they should call it?
Infotainment. You know, we joked around they could call it mayhem, fluff, weather, and sports. But seriously, it's a form of infotainment.
Would you allow them to say, caution, may contain news-like material?
Actually, that is in our petition as an option.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jason Salzman is chairman of the board of the Rocky Mountain Media Watch.
Next up, the case for chubby sitcom characters and gawky soap opera stars, and the case of the missing Bukowskis.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the hit Spanish-language soap opera, or telenovela, Yo Soy Betty La Fea, aired its eagerly awaited final episode on the U.S. network Telemundo. Produced and originally aired in Colombia, I Am Betty the Ugly, as the title translates, drew tens of millions of fanatical viewers throughout the Spanish-speaking world. Joining me now is Kevin Baxter, arts editor for the Miami Herald and a former Latin TV reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Kevin Baxter, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Now, dozens of telenovelas are produced every year. Why has Betty become such a huge hit?
Well, Betty's become a huge hit because it really breaks the mold for what a novella is. It's comic in a lot of ways. It's serious. And it also, it's a feminist novella. There's a moral to it. It's pretty much the anti-novella, if you want to look at it that way.
Can you go through point by point what makes it the anti-novella?
Well, the woman who plays the lead, Betty, in this novella is actually a 27-year-old model. She's quite attractive. But in the show, she's been made to look as ugly as possible, hence the name. Yo soy Betty la Fea, I am Betty the Ugly. And she wears glasses, braces, she has her hair slicked down. She's incredibly clumsy. She trips all the time. But her one redeeming quality is that she's a mathematical whiz. And she works at a fashion house in Colombia, and she's really the brains behind the operation. And over time, we're taught to love Betty and to respect Betty by who she is, her character, her brains, and not her physical appearance.
What was the reaction to Betty in Colombia?
Well, the reaction's been incredible. There was one episode when Betty was offered a bribe. The bribe was a sizable bribe, and it was sort of the answer to her dreams. The producers let the bribe sort of sit there for a week and had Betty sort of stewing over what to do. And members of the Colombian parliament called in the producers and said, you have to have this end this way. Betty has to do the right thing. The public opinion polls taken, making sure that Betty stayed on this moral path that she had chosen. And the Colombian politicians made no bones about the fact that they considered this to be a serious national issue, that if Betty could be corrupted, then the Colombian society as a whole really had no chance. And that's how important it's become.
Well, the U.S. Spanish-language network Telemundo airs Betty over here. So what's the reaction been to Betty in the U.S.?
Telemundo could not have asked for a better recipe for getting out of its dismal ratings problems. 2 years ago, they had about 8% of the primetime Spanish-language viewership in the U.S., with Betty La Fea, for her time period, they now have a 30% share. In Miami, it's the number one show in its target demographic, which is 18 to 49. It's the number one show in any language. It's beating Friends. It's beating Ally McBeal.
Over time, Betty becomes more and more attractive. The hair fluffs up. The eyeglasses go away. Suddenly, she's beautiful. And yes, this week she gets the fairy tale ending. She gets to marry the boss's son. And from what I've read, this is an enormous letdown to many viewers of Betty the Ugly. Why do we have to define it the same way time after time? Happiness is beauty and a really good husband.
Yeah, it is sort of a traditional ending, but it's a traditional ending that's been turned upside down. In most of the novellas, it's the man who makes the choice, and he has the competing lovers. In this case, it's Betty. Betty had everything going for her, and at the end, it got to the point where we really didn't care that she had become beautiful.
Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Kevin Baxter is the arts editor for the Miami Herald and a former Latin TV reporter for the Los Angeles Times.
A definitive study of television programming and advertising going back 30 years has yielded a shocking revelation. People on TV are slender and attractive, in spite of eating lots of unhealthy crap. Thus have researchers at Rutgers University surmised that unhealthy TV diets, in programming and advertising both, contribute to the nation's sorry eating habits. Carol Bird Breadbenner is a professor of nutrition at Rutgers. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here.
What message is TV sending?
Americans really are seeing a lot of activity on television telling them to eat these really, I have to say, delicious foods, but they're also very high in calories, and they're not delivering the nutrients that many people need. And then I think they also are getting this dissonant message, because when we look at the individuals who are actually engaged in the food activity, either eating them or talking about them or using them as props, they are slender, attractive, healthy, and there's no consequence associated with eating these calorie-laden, fat-laden foods. And we know that that's not the case.
Well, let's listen to one of those commercials and see what they're eating and what they look like.
Well, I just tasted Roy Rogers' new sourdough club with ham and turkey and Swiss and tomato and bacon on toasted sourdough bread. Man, it really took me back, because those days Dad made my sandwich were great.
Well, that's a mouthful. What does this kid look like?
The kid is cute little, probably 8 or 9 year old, typical size, certainly not overweight. Now, of course, it's him speaking years later as an adult, and we certainly don't know what he looks like because he's off screen. But if he's like the typical person that we see in these fast food restaurant advertisements, he's very good looking, he's an adult white male, and he's slender and probably very athletic looking as well.
Now, there is at least one television program which presented reality as you, a professor of nutrition, know it. That show is The Simpsons. Tell me about it.
Simpsons are amazing. I think we've been watching that for a number of years. We're doing a longitudinal study looking at them, and their diet is pretty wild in many cases. It's heavily into Duff beer, as you know, and donuts. But I have to say, Marge is a good mom. She serves a pretty decent dinner when you look at it on the table. It's usually got some kind of vegetables, usually something green like peas or something of that nature, maybe broccoli. It's hard to tell in cartoons exactly. Probably some kind of potato, it looks like, and some kind of protein-rich food.
Are you saying you're never going to eat any animal again? What about bacon?
No.
Ham?
No.
Pork chop?
Dad, those all come from the same animal.
Yeah, right, Lisa. A wonderful, magical animal.
So what do you exactly have in mind? Dietary warnings? This show is rated T for trans fatty acids?
No, not at all. I think the kinds of things that we are looking for, in fact, the reason why we did these studies is to work with health and nutrition educators. And if there is an opportunity to work with programmers, we can send these messages that are worthwhile.
Within the last year, the big controversy when it was disclosed that the drug czar, the head of the White House Drug Policy Office, had essentially been paying networks to include positive drug messages in their programming. Have you thought about some sort of nutrition payola program, if they'll take out one Big Mac and stick in some whole grain bread?
Well, I think we could give them examples of changes that they can make easily. It could be just background messages. For example, instead of having them conversing over soft drinks or ice cream, it might be just as easy to have them snacking on an apple.
Carol Bird Breadmenter, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Carol Bird Breadbender is a professor of nutrition at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Carol Bird Breadbender on the media makes your TV dreams come true.
I hope this doesn't offend you, but I've had the most stressful day, and I really don't have the energy to make a lot of small talk. Plus, I'm not very hungry. Would you mind terribly if
I think I know where this is headed. You don't have to say it.
Frazier, could we just go someplace and have sex?
Well, I'm flattered, and the thought is very tempting.
But I was just tucking into this sprouted wheat bun with arugula and a thin slice of tofu. It's loaded with nutrients and provides 75% of the recommended daily allowance of riboflavin. What kind of cheese is on your salad?
Blue.
Mine too. Check, please.
A Chinese treatise on war has charged up bestseller lists across the nation. It's called The Art of War. Its author, Sun Tzu. A compelling how-to on winning a war, Sun Tzu's wisdom has since been applied to many modern settings, ranging from the trading floor to the field of waste management.
Reading that a book you told me about, The Art of War by Sun Tzu. I mean, here's this guy, a Chinese general, wrote this thing 2,400 years ago. And most of it still applies today. Balk the enemy's power. Force him to reveal himself. You know, most of the guys that I know, they read Prince Machiavelli. And I had Carmella go and get the Cliff Notes once, and he's okay. But this book is much better about strategy.
Tony Soprano, literary tastemaker. Who knew? Since Tony mentioned the book in two episodes of The Sopranos last month, Sun Tzu has been flying out of bookshops all over the country. After the April plugs on HBO, the Oxford University Press placed a small ad in the New York Times. It read, "Tony Soprano fears no enemy. Sun Tzu taught him how. The Art of War, the book for bosses." In an interview with the Boston Globe, Sarah Leopold of the Oxford University Press said that there was no doubt about it. The spurt was due entirely to The Sopranos. Every copy sold out. Which raises the question, would Tony's colleagues have purchased the book or gotten it off the back of a truck? Which leads ineluctably to yet another question. Book theft is rampant in this country, so who is doing the stealing? In New York City, there are tables lining avenues all over town, overflowing with books that have fallen off the backs of trucks. The deal is, the boosters steal the books, sell them to the guys with the tables for a quarter of the cover price, and they sell it to the rest of us for half of the cover price. Except that we would never do that. Who would buy a stolen book? For that matter, who would steal a book? Ron Rosenbaum thinks he knows who.
I was going to write a column about
the kinds of people who like Bukowski and Burroughs, the killer bees, I thought. There's a certain personality type. And then I tried to buy a couple of Bukowski books. I found they're not on the shelves of this Barnes & Noble. They're behind the counter. Then a couple weeks later, I went back to get a Martin Amis. He's not on the shelves. He's behind the counter. Then a couple weeks later, I went to try to get a Raymond Chandler as a gift to someone. He's behind the counter. And suddenly it crept up on me. I realized that Barnes & Noble has a kind of shoplift wall of fame or wall of shame, all the most frequently shoplifted books.
Ron Rosenbaum is the author of a collection of nonfiction called The Secret Parts of Fortune. He got the Barnes & Noble clerk to share the list of the most shoplifted. Barnes & Noble declined to answer our questions, so consider the following privileged information.
Here's the authors they gave me. Martin Amis, Paul Auster, George Bataille, William Burroughs, Italo Calvino, Raymond Chandler, Michel Foucault, Dashiell Hammett, Jack Kerouac, and Jeanette Winterson.
On both coasts and points in between, Bukowski is the number one choice of book bandits, and Rosenbaum has formed a personality profile of the perpetrators.
There's a certain kind of person who feels that Bukowski and Burroughs and literature that, you know, dwells incessantly on excrement and vomit and the lower depths is literature about the truth. And I guess they identify with these down-and-out heroes, and so they feel that that somehow validates their desire to just shoplift the books.
Of course, Rosenbaum, who's authored a few books himself, thinks they're fooling themselves.
You know, if you look at who's actually doing the shoplifting, they're not really down-and-out, lower-depths types, but like to pose as being down-and-out, and shoplifting is part of the aura, you know. So I call the frequent shoplifter of Burroughs and Bukowski Bukowski man, because they're always saying, oh yeah, Bukowski man, only Bukowski man really lays it on the line. He's the only one who can tell the truth, dude.
But the majority of book thefts are not the work of the Bukowski man. Tom Cushman, who managed a number of bookstores in this city, currently Ivy's and Murder, Inc., says thieves are not motivated by literary notions or even personal taste, except for money.
It's a romantic notion, but the thing is that book theft is really is a much more pedestrian thing. It's no different than stealing anything else.
Books don't have to portray drug abuse or actionable sexual practices to attract the professional.
When the Harry Potter book came out, we kept those behind the counter.
Presumably not from a light-fingered pre-adolescence.
No, certainly not. I mean, that book was such a popular theft item that even the guys who deliver the boxes of books to us were stealing them. That was definitely a hot item on the streets.
Whether a book is ripe for the five-finger discount depends on a few key factors, says Cushman. Location. Are they tucked away or in plain view of the clerk? Resale prospects. Did I mention Harry Potter? And yes, thieves do judge a book by its cover, especially those of attractive trade paperbacks, like Paul Auster's.
Where I really came into a great deal of contact with book theft, I was a manager at a Rizzoli down in Soho, and there we had like seven authors that were the most popular stolen books. And out of the seven, Paul Auster was actually the only living author. He had the distinction of being the only living author who was most stolen.
Well, all I can say is I'm mystified. I don't know what to make of it at all.
Novelist Paul Auster is the author of many books, though his New York trilogy is the most stolen.
I guess you feel pleased that there are people who actually want to read you so much they're willing to break the law to do it. But at the same time, you feel that, maybe your work just appeals to the criminal elements in society. I mean, I don't know.
Bookstore manager Tom Cushman says that in his experience, book crooks are not breaking the law to read.
I had a whole stack once of about 20 or 30 copies of the New York trilogy of his that somebody just came in and just took the whole stack.
Would Auster feel better if he knew readers rather than professional thieves were stealing his books?
Yes, I suppose I would. Somehow mixing commerce into all this makes it a little unsavory. If it were some passionate, poor person who wanted to read the book, then I could understand it a little better.
One place where the book thief is more likely to read what he hath took is the public library. And library theft tends to lean toward the practical more than the popular. News you can use, so to speak. How-to books, ranging from auto repair to divorce, how to ace the GEDs, and the joy of sex. Also, anything, and this is from libraries across the country, anything to do with witchcraft, the occult, UFOs, or astrology. And there are some other popular choices for the kleptomaniacally inclined. The Bible, for instance. Ron Rosenbaum.
Well, I guess the people who are shoplifting haven't had a chance to flip through the Ten Commandments, you know, to thou shalt not steal, you know. Maybe afterwards they'll return them out of remorse.
Laura Clark, press officer for the American Library Association, conducted a national ad hoc email poll of library theft for On the Media. She heard from 70 libraries across the country. She said that one name that never, ever came up was Charles Bukowski.
You know, I personally, I've got to admit, didn't know who that was. And it didn't come up anywhere in my questioning to people.
So what's with the five copies of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus being stolen from Orchard Beach, Maine?
You know, who knows? Are people embarrassed to buy it?
You did get a response from a prison library.
We did hear from a prison library, and the dictionary was their most frequently stolen, and books of poetry.
I was very interested in the behavior of some moral guardians of the community that some of the librarians wrote about.
Right. The idea that people would remove books from our collections because they don't want anyone to have access to them is very troubling.
For instance, one library in Maine went through three copies of Heather Has Two Mommies.
I think it's unfortunate that people will resort to stealing to kind of force their will on a library community. There's a minister that works with the Library Association, and one of the things he says about that is, he's like, you know, if you can take this book out of the library, what's going to keep you from taking my favorite book, which is the Bible, out of the library?
And a lot of people do steal the Bible.
They do, actually. A couple of librarians, including one in Salt Lake City, she said that the Bible was their most frequently stolen book.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Laura Clark is press officer for the American Library Association.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from David Sirchuk and Kathleen Horan.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And remember to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.